The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Carolyn Marvin. I'd like to welcome all of you tonight to our panel, Usage and Abusage, and I'd like to thank the Free Library for making this possible tonight, and especially Andy Cahan, who's worked so hard on it. And I'd like to introduce our panelists to you tonight, one by one, as they're sitting from right to left. Mark Lieberman lives in Philadelphia, where he is a professor in the Department of Computer and Information Science and the trustee professor of phonetics in the Department of Linguistics. A lot of his work is about how and why we pronounce things. What have I done? Oh, at the University of Pennsylvania. Just took it for granted. A lot of his work is about how and why we pronounce things the way we do. And with Jeff Pullum, a professor of linguistics at the University of California at Santa Cruz, he is the author of a widely respected, very entertaining blog where linguists talk to each other and their readers about language. It's called The Language Log, and you can easily find it on the web. Far From the Madding Gerund is a great book pulled from their postings to The Language Log. Mark is also the director of the Linguistic Data Consortium, which is a worldwide organization of universities, government labs, and companies that use computing technology to collect and share an enormous number and variety of language texts and databases of all kinds for doing research on what language is and how it works. Erin McCain is a guardian of dictionaries who calls herself a dictionary evangelist, and she's been called America's Lexicographical Sweetheart, which I think is a very musical title to be known by. She was the editor-in-chief of the new Oxford American Dictionary, and she is the chief consulting editor of all American dictionaries for Oxford University Press. She's the author of these three books, Weird and Wonderful Words, More Weird and Wonderful Words, Totally Weird and Wonderful Words. And for something different, she's written another book called That's Amore, and that's also about words. If you want to know what the folks look like who sit on the various boards and oversee and think about dictionaries, take a look at Erin. She's also on the board of the Wikimedia Foundation, which is dedicated to encouraging, developing, and making available the content of wiki-based projects such as the Wikipedia, free of charge to the public. You obviously know that wiki projects are those that are collaboratively edited by their own users. She also sits on the board of XRefer, which makes available a huge array of linked online reference services to libraries and information centers. And though a dictionary maven, she claims to be no good at Scrabble. But she does want to make dictionaries more fun than their reputation generally suggests they are. And she has a blog about dresses, truly. John McWhorter is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which is a think tank for developing and disseminating new ideas that foster greater economic choice and individual responsibility. He is an associate professor of linguistics at Berkeley. His specialty is language change and contact. Along those lines, he is the author of The Power of Babel, a natural history of language, about how languages arise, change, and mix. And another book, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music in America, and Why We Should Like Care. He's written on Black English and Creole languages, and he's written for every important opinion journal and newspaper you can think of, New Republic, Wall Street Journal, Chronicle of Higher Ed, The National Review, The Washington Post, The New York Times. you get the idea. He recently appeared on NPR talking about sexually and ethnically offensive taboo words, which is hard to do these days in broadcasting, since uttering any one of them could pretty much bankrupt public broadcasting, given the FCC's new rules about using bad words on the air. Finally, Ben Yagoda lives in Swarthmore. He's written four books, a biography of Will Rogers, a history of the New Yorker, a book called The Sound on the Page, Style and Voice in Writing, and a brand new book I've been reading called When You Catch an Adjective, Kill It, which dispenses sage but never martinet advice about what makes writing effective and engaging while explaining lots of things you never realized about usage. He's also co-edited The Art of the Fact, a historical anthology of literary journalism, which makes sense because he's an English professor who also directs the journalism program. This is very unusual, an English professor directing a journalism program at the University of Delaware. And he also gets the word out. He's written for Slate, Esquire, the New York Times Book Review, American Scholar, Rolling Stone, and occasional language columns for the Chronicle of Higher Education. So these are people who think about words, judge words, use words, analyze words, and we're going to ask them some questions tonight. So, all right. I thought I'd start off by asking a question about this debate about prescriptivism and descriptivism. And as I understand it, and you can certainly correct my understanding, the idea of descriptivism is that we don't really need to worry so much about rules about good usage because we all know how to speak the language. That's what we do. And language is a kind of cultural organism that evolves. And what we need to pay attention to is the sort of the ways that most people use it, and that will tell us what so-called correct usage is. And the prescriptivists are folks who think, rather, that language is more like a difficult skill that you have to master and you have to work at it, and you need to know some rules about that to guide you so that you will become a master of usage. Now, I don't know whether or not that is a fair way to talk about it, but what I want to ask you, and just anybody can respond, is from a descriptivist point of view, would it be better then if we didn't worry about the rules of languages and correct and proper usage at all, but just listened more, talked more, and read more? And from a prescriptivist point of view, do prescriptivists think that rules have an impact on the language in any way? And if so, what is that impact? Do rules about language make a difference in how the language evolves or changes, or do they just make a lot of people who are snobs and think that they speak better than everybody else?
There's a lot in there.
I think if we look at the collected writings of John and Mark, all multiple volumes, probably we could glean an answer, but it's a tough. I mean, when I hear prescriptivism, I always think of one sentence, which is Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. And I believe that that ad campaign, I can't prove this, started the prescriptivist movement as we know it, because people were upset, offended, outraged that that campaign didn't say Winston tastes good as a cigarette should.
Well, every generation has their own ad that inspires this. Think different.
Yeah.
Remember that one?
Yeah.
Every generation has an ad that
think
riles.
Differently. I mean, that wouldn't fly, would it? No.
Ain't She Sweet the Song? Yeah. People upset.
It really?
In the teens, 20s, late teens, yeah. Because it should have been Isn't
She Sweet. Isn't She Sweet, and that would sold three copies.
Seven copies. That's right.
And Fat Swaller, if he hadn't said, one never knows, do one. would never have made it into Bartlett's familiar quotation.
No, he wouldn't.
So,
immediately after the American Revolution, when Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia was published in London because the war was over, the review in the Times spent several paragraphs criticizing his language. And in particular, they objected very strongly to his use of the word belittle, which they said was a barbaric, vulgar American coinage. And actually, he does have the first citation for that word in the Oxford English Dictionary, I believe, the earliest citation. So that, I think, illustrates one of the dynamics, one of the things that happens with this sort of thing. Someone writing in 1780 needed to be aware that the word belittle might get them into trouble with a British audience. And perhaps Jefferson should have known that and avoided using it. I don't know. But you don't need to worry about that today. I don't think that there are any...
The word's okay.
Yeah, the word's okay now. It's made it into the language. And so the question of what constitutes an indictable offense in this area, or a rule that shouldn't be violated, does change over time. I think one important issue here is to separate is from ought. That doesn't mean that ought isn't important. It just means that before coming to conclusions about what you must or mustn't or should or shouldn't do, it is important to try to get the facts straight. And so one of the things that causes a lot of confusion and annoyance back and forth in this area is when someone invents a rule. What often happens, actually, is that some fairly authoritative person expresses a preference. They say that a certain way of expressing things seems awkward to them or might better have been something else. That's what happened with splitting infinitives. John Dryden, writing about an author of the generation before him,
Ben Jonson, wasn't it?
Yeah. Observed that one of the lines in one of Jonson's plays he felt would have been better if the adverb had not been between the to and the verb. And I've just mistaken the facts, which I've just said you shouldn't do. that was actually about the stranded preposition.
Preposition.
And the to in the splitting an infinitive was 150 years later. Another critic made a similar kind of remark of a sort of personal preference stylistic variety, which then was picked up later by other people, other self-appointed authorities, and turned into a rule of grammar. Although until the time that that argument was made, all of the best writers, like Ben Jonson and like all of the people who have split infinitives over the years from time to time, did violate this individual preference. So anyway, linguists, especially people who know something about the history of the language, get annoyed when someone tells them that, you know, it's a rule of English grammar that you shouldn't do something which Jane Austen did and Mark Twain did and Henry James did and Virginia Woolf did and so on. That reaction is interpreted by some people as the argument that anything anyone writes must therefore be okay, that you should never red pencil anything, that you should never criticize anyone's way of speaking or writing. And that's equally ridiculous, because every time, I mean, if you think of yourself as a listener or as a reader, every time someone opens their mouth and says something, every time they write something, you come to some conclusions about not only what they have to say to you, but who they are and what their background is and what you think of them as a speaker or as a writer. And, of course, as a speaker or as a writer yourself, you have to take that into account and consider what effect your choices are going to have on your audience. But with all of that, it people at least whose business is language or who have a personal interest in the way that language has worked and in its history. For us, I think one of the most interesting questions is not what should a writer do or what should a speaker do, but what have writers done over history and what have speakers done over history and what's the nature of the question, what is the background in history of the choice or what's the nature and current usage of the choice that's being made.
People get really upset when you tell them that there isn't a hard and fast rule for something, because people want there to be a hard and fast rule, especially people who don't feel very secure who might not even know that they don't feel very secure in their writing. I think especially writing. People want to think that if they follow these 25 set-in-stone rules, if they never end a sentence with a preposition, if they never split an infinitive, if they never say everyone should bring their books to class, then their writing is good, and you should have no problem with it. But there's a difference between stuff that's correct and stuff that has good style. And people conflate those things. You can have perfectly correct English and have it be terrible style that has no rhetorical grace, that has no communicative verve, and have it be perfectly what people call grammatically correct. And so when you take that prescriptivist rug out from under people and they fall on their butts, they get really upset, which is, I think, a lot of the people who get upset, they blame it on me and other lexicographers. They're like, I looked it up in the dictionary and it was there. And I was like, well, did you read to the end of the entry where we have the usage note that says people don't like this use? Sometimes, usually they say they did, but I know they didn't. And so it's in the dictionary because people do it. And then we tell you how people feel about it. Like the word irregardless. See, people groan, right? It's in the dictionary. Of course it's in the dictionary because people use the word irregardless. Not anyone here, I'm sure. But at the end of it, we wave the big red flag and we say, actually, what do we say? I have the dictionary here. This is great because I never have to memorize.
You use this word at the Free Library of Philadelphia, you will get hooted.
Yes. It says, irregardless, with its illogical negative prefix, is widely heard, perhaps arising under the influence of such perfectly correct forms as irrespective. Irregardless is avoided by careful users of English. Use regardless to mean without regard or consideration for, or nevertheless. I go walking every day regardless of season or weather. So it's in, but that doesn't mean it's great. But we tell you that other people don't like it. But leaving it out would be the equivalent of not putting up the warning sign, you know, warning wet floor. So.
One thing that's interesting, actually, is that there are cases where the general feeling is that something is completely wrong, where the history of it can be interesting. And for me, the one that's always bewitching is Billy and I went to the store as opposed to Billy and me went to the store. And the idea is that Billy and me is wrong because me is not a subject form. And we're just told that that's the way it goes. And it's been said that Billy and I went to the store is now an official rule of English, if only because, especially people in this room and people with certain experiences, we have internalized it so thoroughly that no matter how tired we are, no matter how out of it we are, we would never say Billy and me went to the store. But what's interesting is that Billy and I went to the store doesn't follow the other rules of English grammar. If you look at the way things work, to do that is to flout the internal logic of the language such that it bears mentioning that no child does that spontaneously. Everyone has to be taught not to say Billy and me went to the store. So nobody says good a book instead of a good book. You listen to what's said. But every kid, no matter how much of a book full home they have, they live in Scarsdale, whatever it is, they start with Billy and me went to the store, and then you have to say no, 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 it's Billy and I. And you're always told by somebody that it has to do with subject, but then on the other hand, imagine, who did it? And let's say that it's a multiple group of people over there. You'd say, who did it? Them. Now, the implication is that it's a subject. Them did it. Well, then why wouldn't you say they? Who did it? They. That's very pretentious. It's kind of Hyacinth on Keeping Up Appearances, who would say, they! It's completely. But nevertheless, we think that's fine. Billy and me went to the store is wrong, but somehow me and Billy went to the store isn't. For what reason? It's genuinely not a rule that any linguist recognizes. And yet I've learned that in public I have to say Billy and I went to the store. Or very intelligent people sincerely think that I made a mistake. So it's at the point where it practically is a rule, and we might start having children who never hear anybody saying Billy and me went to the store and are very good at paying attention to their elders. I mean, to an almost pathological degree. And they will break the rule of their own language and spontaneously say Billy and I. But I've always been very interested in that particular little rule.
Well, I don't want to bring up any kettle of worms or what's the proper cliche, but I believe it's Steven Pinker and other eminent scholars who defend the usage. I believe the example was Bill Clinton saying, thank you for supporting Al Gore and I. Or Between You and I was actually named as the number one gripe by BBC listeners of language misusage. There are, as you folks probably know much better than I, defenses for that. John, is that acceptable? Thank you for supporting Al Gore and I.
I know that people say it out of an internalized sense that just you should use I in situations where you're worried that me is going to be wrong, which
right.
is the best that many people can do. But no, I'm not aware of anybody okay. who's defended
right.
I know it's inevitable.
Well, I'm not going to go there. So. But the best example that I came across of a rule that, I mean, unlike the John Dryden thing where he sort of started it and you could see it, but apparently the rule, has anyone ever heard that you're not supposed to begin a sentence with and or but? No one has ever put that forth in any official form as a rule.
It's in William Sapphire's fumble rules, I think.
As a non-rule? Or
That thing where he writes this whole passage where every sentence breaks the rule that's supposed to be
well, elucidating? Well, Dennis Barron did an article looking at that, and what he found was dozens and dozens of cases where usage guides would say, the rule about not starting a sentence with and or but is not a good rule. So it was just defied but never actually said. If someone can show me a source where that is presented as a real rule, I will be surprised.
Let's talk about politically correct language. And in particular, what about this debate that we need a pronoun, a singular pronoun, that describes a person that is neither a male nor a female pronoun, so that we have he, she, it, and then we have a pronoun that somehow will refer to a human being but not specify gender. Why is it that it's so hard for us to figure out how to solve that problem?
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the book about that kind of pronoun is academic, out of print, costs $800. That's probably one of the reasons. you didn't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, yeah, it took me a long time to get it.
Well, no, I think there's a very good answer, and the answer is they. I mean, Marx said it. Everyone picks up their ears. I forget the exact quote, but it is so natural, and it was used by, Shakespeare, King James Bible, Oscar Wilde, Jane Austen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then round about sometime in the 1800s, it was decreed that that was not proper, that it would be his. Then about 100 years later, people said, wait a second, that's not really sensible either. And I believe we are right at just about the tipping point of acceptability. It's of there. It already is in speech, and I believe that within a couple of years it will be in writing as well.
There's a degree of perfection that I think we're often taught to seek in how pronouns work. And so often when I've told students about they or other people, people keep saying, but it's plural, but it's plural, but it's plural, which, you know, certain reading it is. But pronouns tend to be messy. In Russian, to say my wife and I, or me and my wife, you say, and what that means is we, and the wife. And that's what I would say about me and my wife. I'd say we and the wife. Now, you can wrap your head around how that might come in, because you and the wife are a we, but you can't say in Russian, I and my wife. You have to say we and my wife. They don't have any problem with that in Moscow. And yet we could say, but it's plural. But we is plural. In that usage, it isn't. And so in the same way in English, the way I think of it is they is not plural in some usages. But hopefully we can move beyond it. But my editors will not allow it. And he said, of course, hopefully
you,
too.
You would
say, let's murmur it. Hopefully it's right.
But who does it hurt? I mean,
this
besides the
crowd.
Guy over there.
A lot of people, it bothers a lot of people. There's no question about it. It's one of those things that raises some people's hackles, despite
their hackles.
Right, it raises their hackles.
despite the history. One thing that's worth mentioning here is that if we were just talking about finding a new non-gender-specific word for some category of some profession or something of that kind, we wouldn't have so much trouble with it. In fact, of course, people have made various choices in different areas. They've, you know, removed the man from chairman and used just chair. They've decided that actor would count for people of both genders, and so on. They've made different choices in different places. Because not making a new noun or making a new verb is relatively easy to do. Coining new pronouns is a lot harder. Getting them accepted is a lot harder, let's say. It's easy enough to coin them.
Yeah, and the list of possibles goes on for
right. There are many people who have called
Don. Don, yeah.
See.
We use pronouns too much to bring in new ones like that. That's her.
The amazing thing about there, it's so natural nowadays. There was an article in the New York Times just a few weeks ago that quoted the opening paragraph of E.B. White's essay, This is New York, or is it Here is New York? I don't remember. And it said, no one should come to New York unless they're prepared to be lucky. And this is 1949, and I said, that's not 1949. So I looked it up, and the original said no one should come to New York unless he is prepared to be lucky. And I don't believe that that person made the change maliciously or, you know, surreptitiously, but rather that the they is just now so natural and so ingrained that the person could not write he. Had to write. You have to ask him. I don't know. That's my supposition. So, not that I defend it, but not that I defend misquoting, but I think that's what happened.
Well, if we're going to talk about they, which makes some people uncomfortable, I guess we have to talk about like, which is really the usage of a younger generation, right? Is this something that we're going to learn to say as easily as teenagers say it and as easily as we're learning to say there?
I'm a like speaker.
Ah.
I admit it. I am a like speaker. And I think there was this great piece in the New York Times, and it's not available through the archive search. It was in the early 90s. It was called We Are Like Poets. And it was an op-ed piece talking about all the uses of like. And there are plenty of places where like is a stutter, where it's just to take up some space in the sentence because the speaker doesn't really know what's coming next. But there are places when it's used really to set off what's coming next. I don't have to directly quote somebody, even E.B. White, it seems. And I can say he was, like, really upset. It doesn't mean that he was really, really upset. It meant that it seemed to me that he was really upset. It's a caveat, it's a hedge, and it's very useful. If I want to say that someone was, he was like, I'll be there at 10. He didn't actually say, I'll be there at 10. He gave me to understand that around 10 is when he would show up. And in a time where nobody makes an actual plan, they say, I will call you on my cell phone and you will answer on your cell phone and we will see where we are and triangulate our positions. Like is very useful. But I think people think of the stereotype of like as the gum-snapping teenage girl who doesn't know what she's saying and has up talk at the end of all of her sentences. And they feel that stereotype is all like speakers.
And John, you put like in your subtitle.
Yeah, I did.
How did that get there?
Well, you know, partly it was to get attention.
But like, wow, dope.
It was also because that like actually does convey important grammatical information. It conveys importance about one's attitude towards what one's saying. Like, for example, imagine if you looked in the paper and you saw something like, the governor just didn't sign the bill. You wouldn't see that. It wouldn't be the governor just didn't sign the bill. It wouldn't be called that. The just sounds kind of informal. It conveys that you expected the governor to do it, but he didn't, and you're rather surprised, and so the governor up and didn't sign the bill. That little just is called pragmatic by linguists, and it's something that is most common in spoken language. That like is a pragmatic marker. So if a Martian were going to write a grammar of English, then that like would be one of the things they would catch. They wouldn't know about gum snapping or not being a man and being under 20 or something like that. They just know that they would hear this like and they'd include it as that. And there are a lot of languages around the world that you see where there is something like, and because we're coming at it from the outside, we just kind of accept it as there. Then when it arises in English, because naturally it arises among a certain subset of people, it sounds foreign. But all languages have ways of hedging in that way. And the like often does it in a way that wouldn't work in any other way. Like, for example, he's like, I'll be there at 8 o'clock, means something different from he said he would be there at 8 o'clock. It actually means there was some uncertainty about it, like it implies that he didn't get there at 8 o'clock.
Or he's
always late. Right. And that's a useful thing for a language to have. Unfortunately, it has that bubblegum smell to it, and I don't know what we can do about it. But, yeah, I think and it's interesting, I don't use it that much myself, but I've always thought of it as something interesting and new that had come into the language.
And there are more formal counterparts to some of likes, to most of likes meanings. For example, if you will, which, you know, will rub a different set of people the wrong way or at least give them an impression you might not want to give them. But no one will suspect you of being a Valley Girl.
I asked a friend of mine who's English to tell me what bothered her most about American speech, because I thought it would be interesting to hear what she heard that we might not hear as easily.
And it's interesting that you assume there would be something that would bother her.
Yes, I had no... Well, she teaches writing.
What?
She teaches writing to undergraduates, so I knew that she would come up with something. And she said that she hates it that Americans use gotten instead of got. And she also, it hurts her ear that Americans say write me instead of write to me. She doesn't like it that Americans say, I'm excited for, rather than I'm excited about
something. I don't like any of the
something.
Ways she says it.
I don't like the color of her socks.
And she says, they also use this god-awful historical present, excuse me, that's a slip. Let me try again. They also use this. This god awful historical present all the time, as in, here's the balcony where Martin Luther King Jr. is standing when the bullet. And
that's not even right.
Response.
No one would even say that. I bring her here. I don't like her. Here's it where he's standing.
Well, those were her gripes.
If you read any short story in the New Yorker, you will see the present tense, but not that usage.
See, my gripe is when people say that was somewhat of a surprise.
Because surprise is absolute, you think? You're either surprised or not?
I think
the somewhat part.
I think it's instead of that, something of a surprise. Or that big of a surprise.
Or that big of a surprise. Yes, all of these.
Because somewhat is a little bit different.
I hear that, and I certainly hear it among my students. But not only my students, the adults as well. But apparently that's the only group. What
is that related for you with the so-called unique problem, that things can only be unique, they cannot be more or less unique?
That doesn't, I mean, I understand that, but that's just...
Your advice of attorney, do not answer. Don't go there.
That it's the sticking in of the of that I find in that big of a surprise. Why not just that big a surprise?
I have no idea. It has something to do with the rhythm of it, doesn't it? Mark,
well, it's emphasis. It's what's the word, Mark? What's the word for redundant pleonasm? Yes, I think it's the legitimate quote. Legitimate use is that much of a surprise. We would accept that because much is a noun or a pronoun.
Is this partitive, Mark?
So we bring.
Mark, is this partitive? Is that what it is?
Sounds like
I'm trying to take this back to Middle English and thinking that's...
I mean, with all of these things, I think I don't actually know... I can't answer off the top of my head about each of those individual gripes, but I think I'd like to come back to this business about separating is from ought. So everybody, me included, has things that I don't like about other people's language as well as about other people's clothes and other people's cars and other people's ways of walking and everything else. I try mostly to keep them to myself. but I also try, if they really bother me, if they're really getting on my nerves, instead of, you know, throwing things at the television and muttering under my breath and stuff like that, I try to look into it a little bit and find out, well, where did this of come from, and when did it start to be used, and who used it when, and who uses it now? The results are often quite surprising.
Yeah.
It often turns out to be the case, for example, that a usage that people think that it certainly bothers them, and that people think bothers them because it's something new coming in on the part of people who don't understand how the language should be used, is actually an older usage, which has largely slipped out of favor, but is still occasionally used by some people. So one good example of that, I think, is enormity, which some people use and some people have used for 500 years to mean largeness. But these days, it's mainly used to mean horribleness, you know, something bad. It has a negative connotation, and so when someone uses it to mean largeness, then there are those people who are terribly annoyed by that. Now, I don't know whether they would be less annoyed if they knew the history, but maybe it would be therapeutic anyway for them to learn. Then they would at least understand something more about the background of their feelings.
I think the history makes a difference, because a lot of times people think that change in language is bad and should be stopped at all costs. Mm-hmm. And when they find out that the thing that they think is brand new is hundreds of years old and Shakespeare did it, well, if Shakespeare did it, well, it still annoys me a little bit, but it should be all right. It was Shakespeare, after all. And then oftentimes people who are upset at things because they're illogical, and language does not really satisfy a lot of truth conditions. It's not logical in the sense that pure mathematical logic is. So the people who say, well, you can't have this happen because that's plural and that's singular and they don't match, it's not an equation. If it sounds right to English speakers, and if they've done it for hundreds of years, nobody really is in their head saying, okay, this is two on this side, it has to be two on this side, or else the answer doesn't come out right.
Or we don't say am and I.
You know, am and I,
some,
which we
often some dialects of English, but not ours. And so, you know, I'm a good boy. Am and I, wouldn't that be right? Why do we say aren't? and yet Ammon sounds like a hammer on your head. And it's just, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
No language is perfect in that way.
If you want to speak a logical language, may I recommend Esperanto? English is not your language.
Well, let me be the contrarian. I don't want to be with your English friend because I don't like her socks. But defend in some context criticizing the way people speak and the language they use, preferably not to their face but behind their back. And certainly, I think I agree with everything everyone said. It's certainly about the historical and the illogical things. But there is, and you said it earlier, Aaron, bad usage. I'm in the position of teaching writing and correcting writing, and there are certain patterns of the things you see. One that comes to mind is pretentious prepositions. In the last few years, there's been a veritable epidemic of whilst, amongst. I see oftentimes, that's not a preposition, but they say oftentimes instead of often. I maintain my right to mock and rip that because it's needless. It's clearly serving some interest other than communicating the meaning. It's pretentious. So it's not wrong. It's in the dictionary, and it's not even irregular or anything like that. But it's poor writing. It's poor language.
Well, it's archaic and obsolete, and it's okay to say that, I think. Whilst, in the case of things like whilst and amongst and so on.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you've mentioned the dictionary is the place to go when people are uncertain about usage or other aspects of language. But you've had some choice words, Mark, for Strunk and White's elements of style. You've called it a horrid little notebook. And other.
That's more my colleague Jeff Pullum. He's the person who
you can hear him saying.
So where do people go? Where do people go besides the dictionary? If Strunk and White and Fowler and other sorts of references aren't as reliable
Fowler
as they
is
should
not bad.
Be.
It's a little old-fashioned, but for its time, it was pretty good. These days, I think the best single, the reference that I recommend to people is something that calls itself a dictionary, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage, or the Compact Dictionary, which basically has pretty much the same stuff in it. But it's a dictionary in the sense that it's indexed by word, but it has rather long entries, and it doesn't have word definitions in it. Instead, if you want to learn about less and fewer, or about however, or about splitting infinitives, or about stranding prepositions, you can go there, and it will first clarify for you what the analysis is, which people often also get confused about. So everyone learns in high school that they should avoid the passive. It's one of the things that Strunk and White have taught people. But they don't learn what the passive is. And so one of the things I do in my introductory linguistics class is I give people a little quiz in which they're just given a couple of paragraphs of English text and asked just to mark all of the passive verbs. And they're rarely more than 5 or 10% of a class of 110 or 120 students who can even get a passing grade on that test, because very, very few people these days are, even though they've all been taught that they should avoid the passive, no one ever actually taught them what it was that they should avoid. So anyway, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage will help you understand what the analytic issues are. It will lay out what the common prejudices and opinions are, and something about the history, so that you'll understand whose corns you might tread on by saying what, and then you can make your own decisions.
One thing that I'll just toss out there, and there are all sorts of places that you could go with it about Strunk and White, is that I'm not aware, and there could be, but I'm not aware of someone who is well known as a writing stylist, where if you do a little digging about their method and how they pulled it off, that they would have anything significant to say about Strunk and White. If it's so important. Like to take somebody who Whitney Balliot died recently. He was a wonderful writer. And actually, if you read his essays, a lot of what Strunk and White would advise when he's describing what an artist did, he did not actually observe. And I find it hard to imagine him saying, the reason that I'm so good at this is because, first, I observe these Strunk and White rules, and then I've got my artistry. He just kind of wrote. And that seems to be, in general, true. Strunk and White is nice to have, and it gives you a sense of a ground under your feet. And the things that it says aren't ridiculous. But on the other hand, I suspect that it might be less important to getting what you want to say across in a vivid and useful way than we're often led to think.
I think Strunk and White, people want Strunk and White because they want a shortcut. And I think most writers believe that the way to be a good writer is to read good writers and to read them a lot.
It's really the only way.
Yeah. So if you say, okay, I read this very tiny little book, and then I'll be a good writer, instead of reading, well, you know, Henry James and Nabokov and Shakespeare and Austen and, you know, anybody, even reading, you would be better off reading all of E.B. White other than Strunk and White.
Well, especially then, because he doesn't follow the rules.
Well, of course he doesn't follow his own rules.
But there's more going on. I mean, Strunk and White is representative, and the shortcut, it's also a short book, and it's reasonably priced at your local bookstore and can be assigned in courses without a big dent in the wallet. But it's representative of a whole series of dozens of books about writing, William Zinsser and on, which had the same goal of transparency in writing, of simplicity, less is more, not putting yourself into it. And, you know, that might be impossible to achieve, but there's some value in that in certain kinds of writing, in certain kind of context. All the names you mentioned, Nabokov, E.B. White, Whitney Balliot, John Updike, on and on and on, don't do that. They don't do that kind of writing. But if you're writing a term paper or a essay for English composition class, sure, attempting for transparency and clear simplicity is okay. But, you know, John was talking about someone being a notable, outstanding stylist. No, that's not the way to go for that.
Well, I think it's time for us to see what the audience might have to say and ask our panelists. And there will be a microphone going around so everybody can hear what you have to say. And I think there's a question here on the front row already. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I have about 9 questions. I'll be nice and keep it short. I teach writing to adults. I teach grammar for grown-ups. Almost all of my students have university degrees, and they still can't recognize a passive verb. They sometimes argue with me about it. I have one major question. I've noticed that in American speech, we've lost the ability to paraphrase, which is part of why we need like so much. We used to say, he said that he'd be here at 8 o'clock. We don't say that anymore. We say, he said, I'll be there at 8 o'clock. And I wonder if anybody else has noticed that.
Well, I have, I have a big collection of old radio. And I'm a peculiar and obsessive person, so I've listened to this stuff. I mean, listen. There was, before Candid Camera, there was Candid Microphone. And Alan Funt used to somehow not be discovered, because you go around with this big tape recorder. And it's one of the only ways that you can hear somebody in the 40s speaking spontaneously. So if you think about it, that's hard. You can see it in the movies. But people just running their mouth. So I decided to dig up as many Candid Microphones as I could. Terrible show. But you do hear people just talking, like cab drivers and housewives, as it was called then. And they don't paraphrase as tidily as you. They do the direct quotes that sound so sloppy. And so I remember thinking, you can also go to Louis Armstrong's house in Queens, and it's like frozen in 1969. And you go, and you can listen to recordings that he would make with something I assume was large on his lap when his granddaughter was born. So it's just people in the living room talking. It's 1953. You can hear drinks clinking. And they don't paraphrase in the neat way either. So I'm just saying that I think sometimes we might idealize the way people talked back in the day, although I do take your point.
So this gentleman here. Yeah.
I hope you can help me. I've been looking for a good definition of syllable, and I don't understand the concept, really. I mean, besides the intuitive understanding that I have of syllables. So hopefully that's an area of interest for at least one of you.
I think you're the resident syllable expert.
Mark, yeah, thanks. Mark, you're doing that.
Well, one of the interesting things about syllable is that it's usually the last thing that someone like me gets asked about, because when kids come into the first grade or into kindergarten and they're starting to learn to read, they have trouble recognizing that cat has more than one element, has three elements in it, and that the first one is the same as the element of cud or something like that. But they don't have a lot of trouble recognizing that there's something that cat has one of, that cattle has two of, or that catbird has two of. Now, when you, in that sense, it's sort of like trying to define colors to someone who doesn't perceive them, or who wants to be wants to be appropriately scientific and say, well, okay, I know what the intuitive perception of color is like, but now I want to know what that really means and where it comes from. All human languages that we've ever studied are organized in a way which has a very simple, practical reason behind it, which is that you can only open your mouth so far before you have to start shutting it again. So we speak by modulating the buzz that we create in our larynx and the hisses that we create elsewhere in our vocal tract by opening and closing our mouth and moving our tongue back and forth and so on. But in order to do that, we basically have to open and close our mouth. And we erect on top of that a kind of structure where there's a central part, which is the most open part, that's the loudest, where there's the flow of air is the least restrictive, and then there are the margins where we have the consonants and the constrictions and the more constrained flow of air. And basically each maximum in the sonority or in the openness of the vocal tract in general corresponds to our intuitive notion of syllable. Now, phonologists, when they begin to analyze the sound structure of the language, the system and the way that it works, when we begin to talk about the way in which opening and closing your mouth in English is different from opening and closing your mouth in Spanish or in Russian or in Chinese, then other complexities enter the matter. But I think the sort of functional origin of syllables is in this simple fact that you can only open your mouth so far before you have to shut it again. And I'll do that now.
Let's have this gentleman over here.
What about the mispronunciation of words that are commonly used, like height, and also nuclear, and other such words that are used by educated people?
Who here has heard the word height pronounced that way?
Wow.
Who has not? Is that scientific? It's interesting.
Wow, that's interesting.
I have. I think it's a regional thing around here.
This region?
Yeah, this region. Specifically among carpenters, interestingly.
Is it rural? Is it Amish?
No.
So this is something people
neo-Amish.
Say in cities.
Or suburbs.
Okay.
Contractors.
Very sorry.
We're supposed to say something.
We're supposed to say something. Well, lots of people,
let's get
not
this.
All of them presidents, say nuclear. And it's a fairly easy sound change to have happen, nuclear to nuclear. I think that if it didn't involve people dropping bombs, people wouldn't be so upset about it. And people try and seize on very prominent mispronunciations and use those as touch points for being upset about language change in general. And if you've grown up with nuclear, the first time you hear nuclear, it's a little bit of a shock. But then there are other sound differences that you understand as being a regionalism. I'm from North Carolina, and every once in a while I ask somebody to hand me that pin. Right? I want to write something down. I need that pen. And you know I mean pen. And it doesn't if I tell you I'm from North Carolina and I then say pen, instead of pen, which I hardly ever do anymore now that I live in Chicago. And that doesn't engender the same wrath that nuclear does. Because you accept that there's this regional variation.
Well, one case that might resonate a little more with this audience, because I think it applies to nearly all Americans, I'm not sure about people from the United Kingdom these days or other world Englishes, but how about the name of this month? How many of you say February? How many of you say February?
Yeah. Okay. But it takes effort.
Yeah. I didn't think that effort is good.
It should be February.
Yeah, so it was historically, I guess, February, but it has become February for most people, including me. I didn't really realize until I was in my teens that there was even any option to say February, and I've resisted doing it because it sounds pretentious and silly to me. It's different from what most people say, but that is actually quite a bit like the nuclear change. And actually, that kind of what phonologists would call a stop plus liquid plus vowel sequence, like the k sound of nucleus or nucleus, and the L and then the vowel, whether a vowel intervenes between the stop and the liquid is something that people have been going back and forth on in the case of those particular words for a long time. So nucleus, the English word, comes from Latin nucleus, but in Latin, before it was nucleus, it was nucleus.
That's right.
Or nuculus, in Latin. So, you could say that our president is just recovering the pure pronunciations of the Roman Republic, pre-imperial days.
As with the preposition, the thing that bothers me is the pretentious, negotiate. I mean, that just, I don't even know what it's trying to sound like, but I just don't like it.
Who said that?
Lots of people. One of, my boss said that.
It's quite
yeah. So, yeah, you haven't heard that. Yeah.
Negotiations. That's subjectively.
And there's a KYW announcer who says that, at least one on the radio here.
Height is actually fun to me because I don't know if we think about it, but warmth, length. Strength, growth, length, there's this th suffix, and it gives you this abstract noun. And so in a way, there should be a height. Yeah. And I don't know if there was already. But yeah, or for example, sloth starts as slowness. That's where that word comes from. So there should be a height.
But John Ruskin, I think it was, who coined ilf.
Those are ilf?
And greenth, yeah. and another example is the word broughton has become popular in youth culture now.
Isn't that an Amish word?
It all goes back to the Amish. That's definitely the lesson. Broughton.
Let's see. Let's go all the way to the back here, in the very center. Yeah, all the way to the back. Signal. Yeah.
You'll have to pardon my language as I ask these questions. I have three. Two are short. I'm curious to know what dialect in the United States might be the closest to the way the English spoke when they came here. That's one question. The other is, since you mentioned the newscaster, is it language fashion or is it a laziness that have the different newscasters, whether it's the national news or otherwise, dropping the ends of words? So tough or to or doing. I've noticed that a lot on TV. And the last one, I'm curious to know why the British add an R on the end of words that have A. Princess Diana. No, but even even Prince Charles.
That's Massachusetts, I believe.
Well, yes, and Brooklyn.
Cuba.
And Brooklyn, but, you know, even Prince Charles will do that. So I was just curious, and he's quite educated, I guess. So those are my questions. Thank you.
Well, there's a widespread belief that there's some pocket in the U.S. that speaks a pure English of Queen Elizabethan origin that is untouched and perfect, right? That it was good. They brought it right over here from the motherland, and it was isolated in some way, and they stayed right. But the problem with this is that there wasn't a monolithic English in the British Isles, that migration from the British Isles was not in a big lump. That, you know, it went over a period of time, it came from all over the Isles. So there are pockets, but they're couple word pockets. So there are dialectal British words that are now dialectal American English words that have kind of stayed. And there are some that are, Appalachia is usually singled out. North Carolina gets a lot of this. I don't know why. And I think they play it up, too, because you can sell more guidebooks if people think that you speak Elizabethan English. So it's a word here, it's a word there, but there's not that preservation, that language trapped in amber that people think happened. And I think you could map a couple lexical items, you could map a couple grammatical structures, you could map maybe a sound or two, but it would be, everything changes. There's no way to stop it. And at the most, you could get a couple words that would be congruent.
There are a few matters, including the business about syllable final R's, where American dialects in general are more conservative than British dialects. So the reason that most American dialects are R-ful, whereas most British dialects are R-less, is that most British dialects were R-ful at the time of the settlement of the colonies, and the fashion for eliminating syllable final R's in favor of vowel-like syllables, open vowel like syllables, spread from a rather small group, relatively small minority of the population, to encompass most of the population, except in a few places like Northern Ireland and some other places that have preserved the R's. As for why some of the Brits appear to introduce R's where there shouldn't be any, it's the commonest case is the so-called intrusive R, which is substituted in when there is a word that ends in a vowel and a following word that begins with a vowel. So not so much saying Diana in absolute final position, but saying something like Diana is, where then there would be an R that comes in, Diana Riz. And sometimes you can hear that, especially if there's a pause before the vowel that comes out, as someone saying Diana, and you say, why are they saying Diana? But it's usually, I think, because of the influence of the following vowel. And of course, that's a mistaken generalization originally. These are people who were hearing R's in this linking position between vowels because they're acoustically more salient there in the speech of people who still had R's. And they concluded originally falsely, this was a sort of mistaken acquisition through which language changes, that the rule was that you there were no syllable final R's, but whenever you had a vowel at the end of one word and a vowel at the beginning of the next word, you stuck one in. And so they did it whether there was originally an R there or not.
This gentleman here. Yes, you.
Mm-hmm. There is a, excuse me, a rather recent, I think, misusage, and I'd like to know I'm not the only one who's noticed it. It's the based on, the misuse of based on. To be formal, used in an adverbial sense when it should be used only as in the adjectival sense. Something is based on.
Could you give an example?
I happen to have one or two with me.
Oh, good.
We have to work from data.
Pardon me?
We have to work from data.
Of course. There was an issue about pharmacists. Should they or should they not be able to express their religious beliefs in deciding whether or not to fill a prescription for birth control pills, for instance. And this is what came out of Time magazine. The association last year adopted a policy allowing pharmacists to refuse to fill prescriptions based on ethical, moral, or religious grounds. Well, as Churchill might have said, shum prescriptions.
So well, you're thinking that the based on modifies prescriptions?
Refuse to fill prescriptions.
Yeah.
Based on moral grounds.
Based on ethical, moral, or religious grounds.
Well, I think a clearly more general usage, it would be something like on the basis of or something.
Of
like
course.
That, where but a prepositional phrase would be used adverbially. But this is a good case of a question to which I don't know the answer offhand. I don't know whether anyone on the panel does.
I wasn't aware
either. I've certainly heard things like that. What I don't know is whether it's new. So the first thing I would do, I'm sure I've read things like that. They don't rub me the wrong way, but if I were to get interested in them, and since you brought it up, I'm now interested in it, I would look it up. So I would go to the Oxford English Dictionary and find out what they have to say about based on.
May I interrupt? Brian Garner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what does Garner say?
Yeah, Oxford man, Oxford publication. He agrees with me on this.
No, you're kidding. Really? I'm shocked.
But otherwise, I wouldn't have mentioned it. Yeah, but he's quite explicit about it and how it can be misleading. And I'm surprised that you didn't all light up and say, oh, yeah, that's an outrageous thing. Well, and it's prevalent.
What about a bigger picture? If you read one of those books about the history of English, so on one page you have some beautiful scroll in Old English, and it's Beowulf or something. And then, you know, some pages later, then there was Middle English. And I don't even need to mention the main document in Middle English. It ends with tales. And you'll have that. And we all went through it in school. And they're practically different languages. And we kind of hear a certain music behind that. Like there's something noble about it. And then you get to Shakespeare. And, you know, it can be tough going. And that's different from Chaucer. And then you have it to here. And I guess let's call it 1950. So you've got this noble procession. Lucy Ricardo could not have spoken to the person who wrote Beowulf, which means that Beowulf became what Lucy Ricardo spoke through changes. And so the words are all used in different ways. The Beowulf guy thought of a bird as just a small bird. Any old bird was a fowl, and gradually that sort of thing changed. So you've got Lucy. Then, now here's Lucy, and then here's us. And every time we see some new thing happening, we say, well, this isn't right. Well, this is. Now, we know that language changes. And we know that. So how come when it does it here, somehow it's all wrong? What's the difference?
Well, no, the point is this misuse is confusing. It's ambiguous.
What's the confusion?
I think I got the idea of that.
It's every time it...
Clear to me.
It's frequent. Every time it jars because it's wrong. It's confusing. Sorry. It's ambiguous. I mean, what? I'll stop hogging the floor here.
I think we'll. How about this lady here? Yeah.
I'll look into it and try to give you a better answer. Read the weblog tomorrow. I'll say something.
It's going to be tomorrow.
I did want to point out, Mark did say go check the OED. Does everybody here know that the new online, if you have a print OED, well, you're lucky, first of all. And the second of all, it was last edited in 1989. So the online one is the one that is being continually updated, but they started in M. M. Lexicographers like to start at M because people often look at a new dictionary in A, and often by A you haven't shaken all the kinks out yet of a new project, so you start in M where nobody ever opens it up. So, seriously, you start at M. They've also updated things. They've updated things throughout the alphabet, but they tend to be newer words. So something like based might not have been touched since 1989. So if you're looking for something very recent, M through P is a much better bet. So, in fact, if you wanted to see, and of course this is what Mark would do next, he would go and look through Google Book Search, especially to see if it had been in print anywhere.
In literature online.
So if you look for something and the OED doesn't have a record of it, because it's not in the OED doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
And you can look through historical newspaper archives.
Yeah.
If it's really true that this is something whose usage has increased, then we can find out and see. We'll see. So read tomorrow morning.
And you've actually encountered the only four people in the world whose idea of fun is looking up thousands of uses of based on. So what a concept. Maybe we'll get together later. Your database or mine?
We have
back. Actually, I do that for fun, too. That's my nighttime reading.
I meant five, Carolyn. I'm sorry.
But I do have a question, but I just want to mention, I have no authority in any way, but just as an English speaker, although a Southern, and I don't know the difference between pen and pin. The reason it disturbs people like me to hear something mispronounced or grammatically illogical is just that it suggests that the person wasn't thinking about what they were saying, so they lose credibility with me. I don't understand how you could be thinking clearly about what you're saying if you're not thinking clearly about how you say it.
The person wasn't thinking about what they were saying.
Right.
Just wanted to say that. Okay.
Exactly. Okay, I've lost all credibility. But anyway, so that's why that little moment of, saying, hopefully we can go to the store is more disturbing to us than the difference between Beowulf and Lucy Ricardo. But my question is, some things I've come to finally accept that they're going to change. I can't help it. And one of them is uses of words like ironically. And it grates on me. I know when people say ironically, my five friends all re-met and got together. I know that that's not what ironically means. But it doesn't. But the fact that so many people use it wrong, it doesn't seem like there is a good word to replace that. A, is there a good word to replace it? And I would love to be able to use it and see if anybody would ever follow me on it, but I doubt it. But or do we just have to accept that ironically is going to be completely lost to what it really means? And
yes.
Words like massive. Are we never going to have another word for massive that, you know, people just think it means big?
The new one is humongous, but we're told it's wrong.
Humongous is perfectly fine.
No, humongous is big, though.
Words are very talented. Words can juggle. They can have multiple senses at the same time. They can be polysemous. There are some words that have upwards of 25, 30 meanings that we can keep them straight in our heads. But I think that there's a difference between judging someone based on a, well, let's say that your teenage child comes home with their hair dyed blue and several things pierced that weren't pierced when they left the house that morning, and they're wearing different shoes, one on each foot, they're not a pair, and but they're still basically the same person they were that morning. They're expressing themselves in a way that you might not approve of, but underneath it, they're the same child that you love and that you, you know, guide and so forth. How far does someone have to go down the hopefully path before before they become a person that you don't want to deal with? And I think that they have to go pretty far. That these prejudices, especially the learned ones, like hopefully is a sentence adverb, we can say frankly is a sentence adverb, we can say all sorts of things in that sentence adverb position, but we've all learned that hopefully is the bad one. Hopefully is the blue hair of sentence adverbs. So you have to differentiate between the language prejudice that really tells you about someone and the language prejudice that tells you that this person didn't get the same education as I did. And I think we all agree that people can be good thinkers who haven't been taught not to split infinitives.
I'll disagree a little bit. I would differentiate. I mean, to me, hopefully is an example. I agree with you on hopefully. In other words, it was a word that traditionally didn't exist, but there was a need for such a word to express such a feeling. There was no such other word. I hope that. It is to be hoped that. If all goes well, comma. None of those are really very good. So, say?
I was just laughing at it. So
hopefully really fit in. And, of course, that came around about the same time as Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. So there was a double whammy. Now it's pretty much accepted. I used the example of ironically to mean... Well, what used to be fortuitously before fortuitous began to mean luckily. So I would differentiate that because I think I agree with you, I think that there was a traditional, useful, rich meaning for irony and ironic, and if someone used it in what I thought was a thoughtful, knowledgeable, intelligent way, I would think they were a thoughtful, knowledgeable, intelligent person and I'd want to hang out with them. The other person, I would, if they were my son or a loved one, you know, I'd cut them some slack. But otherwise, I think, no, that's not the kind of person that I really feel I could have a meeting of the minds with. So it's like a case-by-case thing, but I wouldn't lay it all on the word. The word's not a demon. It's people use words in hundreds and multitude of different ways in different reasons, and one judges them, makes decisions, makes conclusions for lots of reasons, including their word choice.
You know, this is something to try. Everything that we say, every word and every sentence that we use is the end point of what someone in the past would have thought of as a mistake. It's the language keeps going, and it changes, i.e. the people before think of the new things as wrong, and then that signal fades. And it's just a series of mistakes. If Ben says, I think, well, the word was originally ick. Is he dropping the k? Well, I think we've kind of let that go. Think used to have an ending on it because Old English was a language that had conjugations like Spanish. We don't use that anymore. It wasn't a mistake. Now, surely there were some people, probably, surely, I suppose is a wrong use of that word, in about 1100, there were some people who were saying, you know, why aren't people using the endings? I was over in the next shire, and people were just saying, think. Well, you know, it looks to us now that that was a kind of a futile way of looking at things. And somehow, I think that we think that we're different, that somehow now, today, we can stop these things, that we're modern. But the people who built and then rode on the Titanic thought of themselves as at the end of time, too. You know, they didn't know that all this was coming. They didn't know computers were coming. They're in too many clothes. There's barely such thing as a radio. You've got this overt class system, and you have to go across on a boat because they can't do it on a plane yet. To them, they felt as modern as we do now. They weren't living for us. In the same way, we're not the end either. You know, this is all going to look very peculiar in 100 years. And language has changed a lot since the days of the Titanic, and it's going to keep doing it. They complained about it, and we think, well, those Edwardian blinkered people. I don't know what they're going to be saying about us, but everything that we say started as a mistake. And that really is the nature of what language is.
I do want to say I support your right to have virulent language hates. I hate bananas. Most people love bananas.
Why do people like them so much?
I don't get it.
They're good for like one day when they're in between green and yellow.
Yeah.
There's never a bad banana. There are bad oranges, bad apples. If you get it at that right point, right, Maria?
I'm sorry.
You can count on a banana.
See?
Potassium, one word.
I can pick your spots on them.
But do people think that for language, everybody should feel the same way? Whereas you're all perfectly all right with me hating bananas, right? Is anybody?
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.